And speaking of work, in Australia, they have a law where you can opt out of the boss being able to contact you after hours. It would be illegal to punish somebody who turned their phone off, say, at 5 or did not return or check email. And we were talking about that. John, if we could charge our bosses for these extra hours of calls and emails, they'd probably go way down, say, in a 15-minute block. Sort of like if you call your attorney or accountant, when they pick up the phone, the meter's running. And if you talk to them for 2 minutes, that's a 15-minute block that you've bought of their time, and you are charged. Hey, King John, fortunately, I was never smart enough to possess any information that would be of any value to my boss after hours. John, I spent 28 hours working for a company that demanded that I was available 24 hours a day. My wife and I were on vacation in Florida, and they kept hammering my phone. So while on my vacation, my wife said I could have 1 hour each night to deal with work, and the rest of the time my phone needed to be off. And finally, what about this? John, COVID killed the myth of hustle culture. That is a very good thing. Boomers and Gen X painfully learned how little their loyalty to the company mattered. And they reset their priorities, putting family and health first. Their kids witness this evolution and have a healthier work-life balance because of it. That's one way to put it. I think some of us look at the kids that don't work their asses off, that seem to value their time and culture more, and we think, what's the matter with you? And they say, what's the matter with us? It's 11:36. Eric Zorn is the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel. Hi, Eric Zorn. How are you?
The Picayune Sentinel never sleeps. I'm good, John. Thanks. It's interesting you're talking about this because, you know, I considered myself when I was working at the Tribune for all those years to be really on duty, on call 24/7. And in return, the company was pretty good about not keeping tabs on me every moment of every day, you know, for doctor's appointments or driving kids places and so on. All they cared about was that I got my work done and that I was able to answer the phone if they had questions about it. And I considered that a fair trade-off for a salary position. You know, if they're just calling on you to do extra work outside of, you know, your usual shift, then that's a little different. But when you're a salaried employee, it seems like, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that you'd be reachable for serious questions.
Oh, well, everything up to that last part. And by the way, you know, you're a newspaper columnist, essentially, now, and you were for years and years and years at the Tribune. It would seem to me like as long as your picture, byline, and smart commentary are there, what do they care what you're doing or where you are? I can't imagine it would be any of their beeswax as long as you're turning in the column.
Yeah, and that's the deal that we pretty much had for almost all my career there, was that as long as they could find me when they needed me, if they had a question about anything that I'd written, which they could, especially in the era of cell phones, it's easy to find
right,
me.
But about the last thing you said, Eric, say I'm a mid-level manager for Walgreens or Boeing or IBM, or I'm looking at the buildings around me where I'm sitting right now, and the boss wants to know about some project at 6 o'clock on Tuesday. That could probably wait until 8 a.m. on Wednesday. Yeah, and I know I'm talking about a salaried position here. I'm open to telling the boss, turn on TV, visit with your kids, and let's talk about this tomorrow. No?
Yeah, you could. I wouldn't want to have that kind of relationship with my boss either way. I wouldn't want to turn off my phone on a supervisor, and I wouldn't want to have them fear to call me or not want to call me and let me know what's going on. So, I mean, I get it. And I had the luxury of having very considerate bosses for all the 41 years I was at the Tribune, that they never took advantage of me. I never felt, I mean, they had to call me on vacation sometime and say, hey, this has happened. You want to say something about it, or you want to weigh in, or can you give us some background on this? I was fine on that because during the work week, they were very flexible with me. Now, if your boss is not flexible, if your boss is a tyrant that keeps you lashed to your desk for 8 hours a day and then bothers you at home, that's a different story. But I think it's all in the relationship you have with your supervisors.
Well, agreed. I mean, if my boss, Mary, reached out to me in off hours, I know she does it so infrequently that it would be something I wouldn't mind. Like, oh, yeah, we do need to address this right now. But if your boss is just pestering you about trivial stuff, then you've got a bad boss. Listen to this. Hey, John, I worked in Germany. And you have to have a 12-hour separation from the time you do your last bit of work until you get back in the next day. So if you're sending an email at 10 p.m., you can't go back in until 10 a.m. And I love, 630 says, this idea. What grade, Eric Zorn, did you give the DNC in Chicago?
I gave the DNC an A-. When we spoke last week, I was giving it a B+. Because I was a little concerned about the way they had had handled the timing of the speakers. And I wasn't sure yet whether we had tamped down sufficiently on the protests, which had not, at that point, not gotten out of hand. And they never did. And I have to say that I feel like the city is taking a well-deserved victory lap for how it allowed thousands of protesters to speak their minds, and there were some isolated skirmishes. Police said 74 people were arrested Monday through Thursday. No major injuries to protesters or police. That is a huge victory for the city because people were invoking 1968, and I think we can finally, after two successful conventions here, put 1968 in the rearview mirror and say that Chicago does know how to handle conventions and protest. And I feel really good for Mayor Johnson, and I feel really good for Superintendent Snelling. I feel like, you know, I mean, I'm critical of Mayor Johnson a lot, as you know, but in this case, I just have to tip my press fedora to him and the city.
Do you think the Democrats made a mistake in not having a Palestinian speaker?
Yeah, there was this uncommitted movement, which is where delegates who were elected under the uncommitted banner that, like in Michigan, 13.2% of Democratic primary voters voted uncommitted, and that was largely in response to their feelings about the way the Biden administration was handling the war in Gaza. And so you had a number of delegates there, not very many, but you know, 30 or so, who were uncommitted, and they wanted a speaking slot on the convention floor. And given the number of people who did have speaking slots, I mean, there were like some 50 on Thursday night alone. I mean, there were hundreds of speaking slots. They could have and should have given these people, this movement, 5 minutes to say something from the stage to make them feel heard. And this was the message that the Democrats were putting out during their convention, which is like, we're an inclusive party. And Barack Obama saying, you got to listen to people who disagree with you. You've got to meet them where they are. And then to say, no, we don't want to hear from you when there's significant concern among a lot of people about the number of innocent people who have died in Palestine or in Gaza, I should say. And, you know, I mean, it's a very, very complicated issue, as you know. But these people are concerned about it. And I think giving a voice to those people would have been smart politically. I mean, no matter how you feel about the issue, I think that to say that 13.2% of these voters, there were 600,000 uncommitted primary voters in the Democratic primaries. These are people who are concerned about this enough to vote uncommitted, to get out to the polls and vote. And if you want their vote in November, I think you have to at least show them that you're listening to them. And that would have been my recommendation
if I were running the convention. I was wondering if the reason they didn't ask a Palestinian or pro-Palestinian person to speak, although Kamala Harris did say things about the right to sovereignty of the Palestinian people, and that was seen as threading the needle properly, that we're still pro-Israel, such as it is, but we also see the legitimate claims of the Palestinian people, which is not a pro-Hamas statement, of course. And she said something like that and got plaudits for it. I wondered if then the reason that they didn't have somebody reinforce that from that community is they were worried about what that person would say. Would they pull the rug out from underneath them?
Right. And I did see a copy of the speech that the pro-Palestinian people were going to deliver. And it said, for 320 days, we've stood together demanding to enforce our laws on friend and foe alike to reach a ceasefire, end the killing of Palestinians, free all the Israeli and Palestinian hostages, and to begin the difficult work of building a path to collective peace and safety. And that's what they were planning to say. Now, could they have gone off script like Bill Clinton went off script? Yeah, they could have. And maybe the answer would have been to have them do a video that would have been shown to the delegates rather than a speech. I don't know. I just feel like it helps. It enhances the image of your party to act like you are listening to the other side and you're not afraid of the other side. And I don't think it would have cost them any votes to have given them, like I said, 5 minutes on stage like they gave so many other people.
Yeah. Somebody sent me a note and said, oh, I didn't know that hashtag Me Too was over. Bill Clinton gets to speak now, huh? And that's not, you know, and the energy behind Me Too has passed. There are other issues of the day. Bill Clinton is certainly in the old camp on that. And yet there he was being embraced by Democrats. And somebody sent me a note and said, why or how is it that these Democrats still love Bill Clinton, still invite Bill Clinton? The Monica Lewinsky affair is very much in the rearview mirror, but I think they're between a rock and a hard place. It's quite conspicuous to not invite him, and yet you got to deal with him when he's there. And he's not the speaker that he once was he?
Well, I have looked into the record on some of these accusations against Bill Clinton, not Monica Lewinsky. I think everybody acknowledges what happened there and would consider it maybe workplace harassment, but wouldn't be actual sexual assault. But there are these questions about Paula Jones, and I'm forgetting the name of the other woman who raised rape allegations against him. Those are fairly credible, I think. As I look at them, have studied them in the past, it is troubling. His record is troubling, and I think that the Democrats just are whistling in the dark past that record.
Yeah, no kidding. A couple of other things I wanted to talk to you about. We were wondering earlier today, what is going to be the higher number of White Sox losses today or the heat index today? Looks like the heat index today is going to exceed 101 or 102. You have been following the White Sox maybe better than anybody this year in terms of their futility. Where are they on the all-time worst baseball division that you created?
Well, right now the Sox are 31-101, which is a winning percentage of .235. And if you play that out to 162 games, that would be 38 wins and 124 losses, which is four more than the 1962 Mets, who've sort of set the modern record for futility when they lost 120 games. They were 120-40. Now, the Mets didn't play two games because they got rained out, meaning that 120 is maybe artificially low. They were a really bad team, so the odds that they would have lost at least one of those games is pretty high. But right now, at this point in the season, I've been keeping track of where they are. The Sox are 31-101 after 132 games. The 62 Mets had won three more games at this point. They were 34-98. The Detroit Tigers of 2003, who were really awful also, were 33-99. And you got to look also at the 1916 Philadelphia Athletics, who were widely considered to be the worst team in modern baseball history. This is before the 162-game season. They were 30-102 at this point in the season. So they were just one game worse than the White Sox. For the White Sox to avoid losing 121 games and getting their name in the record books, they're going to have to play 11-19 over the last 30 games. That's at .367. That's, you know, winning 1-3, and right now they're at .235 in terms of winning percentage. They've got to win eight more games to not end up with a worse record than the 1916 A's. They've got to win eight more. That's their magic number. and that's, so they got to go 8-22, and that's playing at .267 baseball. That's .267 winning percentage. And right now they're at .235.
11-19 sounds doable. 11-19, you said they need to go to avoid beating the worst team in modern baseball history.
It sounds doable, but it's way better than they've been playing all season. And it looks like they're going to be putting their main stud pitcher out to pasture for the last few weeks of the season because they don't want to ruin their trade possibilities with him. So it's a really interesting race to the bottom here. And I've been following it all year just because they started off so poorly. I thought, is there a chance that they could be the worst team in modern baseball history? And I think right now the smart money would say that they're going to exceed 120 losses and they're going to be the standard by which bad teams – in the modern era are measured. So it's a pretty interesting season to watch.
It's one of the things I wanted to bounce off you, Eric. Let's pause and come back to that. Also, just a couple of quick notes from WGN Radio listeners. 773 texted in to say, I agree with Eric Zorn about the Democratic National Convention. 630 said, the Democratic National Convention absolutely deserves an A++. Once again, Eric Zorn has no idea what he's talking about. That was the best convention ever put on. I will ask you this, not that any of us remembers any old conventions, but I mean, name a better convention for one of the major political parties. That really was top to bottom. The city was good. The weather was good. The police were good. The protesters were good. The speeches were memorable and maybe decisive. The needle has moved, and you wonder, given the short ramp, they'll stick. What the hell's the matter with you, Eric?
I'm a tough grader, man. I think that they blew the chance to have most of their main speakers in prime time.
Oh,
they
yeah.
couldn't keep their
That's
schedule
true.
Together.
That's true.
That was a mistake. I mean, it was A-minus, A-plus, okay. I mean, I still think it's A-minus. I think that there were a few things. They had some credentialing problems. I had some friends who were from out of town covering the convention. They were complaining bitterly about the seating and the credentialing issues they had. Minor stuff, yeah, and it's maybe too media-centric. But it wasn't perfect, but it was pretty close.
Yeah, it was good. And I will agree with you that while this maybe doesn't matter that much, if the idea is you're going to find a smart and positive way to send off Joe Biden, you put him on the first night, which is not really a prime time spot, but it made sense. Bookend it with the current president and who Democrats hope would be the next president, but then to make him wait until after 10 o'clock and his speech goes an hour was bad planning on everybody's part, or at least execution. Well, working at the office and then still having to work from home, weekends, vacation, because the boss wants more help. 630 said, hey, John, Eric Zorn is exactly right. Are you even listening to this, Eric? Wow. Work from home is another example. It results in a lapse of separation between work and home. It's a trade-off as long as the employer or employee doesn't abuse it. But somebody else said, I was on vacation and I got a call from work and I gave a quick answer to their question, which as it turned out was not appropriate. And eventually it cost me my job. I still think about my decision to answer that call. Yeah, that's the thing, too. If your head's only halfway in the game because it's a weekend or a vacation and you give them some response, but it's not maybe a fully executed thought, be careful. Maybe you shouldn't take that call. Yeah. Eric, you may or may not have heard earlier we were talking about the athletic feat that maybe you had as a child but you still carry around. I was watching the Little League World Series, which was won with a walk-off bunt this year, and the kids in Florida were so happy and the kids from Taiwan were so sad. But I think a lot of us have memories. It might have been in gym class or Little League or soccer. Do you have a memory that you carry around from your youth sports days?
I do. You know, I played organized basketball for a long time. I played, you know, I was on school teams all the way through high school and, you know, scored a lot of points and had a lot of good games. But the game that I remember was an intramural game that I played when I was at the University of Michigan. And I was on a hall of, we were in the honors hall, so basically a bunch of nerds. And we were playing an intramural team of football players. They're real tough guys and really athletic. But we had some good players on our team, including my roommate, who was a deadly shooter. I played with him in high school, and so he and I were sort of holding on the fort in this team. And we were down by a point with about 10 seconds left, and I took the ball down and got a pass and put up a 20-foot shot that went in, and we won the game. And that was my, like, best moment in sports. And it wasn't even, like, nobody was watching even. It was just, you know, the people watching the IM game, but it was one of those things that sticks with me. That people say, "What was your best moment in basketball?" And that was it.
And that's a basketball moment, but nothing else. And that's classic. That's beautiful. And I've heard from a lot of people like that, that it was not something that was in front of 10,000 people in the stands. It wasn't the winning touchdown for the state championship game, but it was just some little private moment that resonates even still, huh?
Yeah. I still remember a home run that I hit in Little League baseball. It was like youth league. It wasn't official Little League. And I just, you know, I don't think it won the game. I just remember the sight of the ball going over the left fielder's head and running around the bases and my teammates mobbing me at the plate and so on. But those kind of memories, like one thing, you think of all the games that you've played and all the shots you've missed and all the strikeouts you've had and all the everything like that. And then and these little things stick with you. And that's one of my memories of youth baseball. So I think that's one of the magic things about sports, is that winning feels better than losing hurts. So that you tend over time to remember that. And you think about like being a Bears fan, right? I mean, well, it was 85 when the Bears won, or I guess 86, they won the Super Bowl early 86. And that still, it still feels good, right? All the years of mediocrity between there, still that pleasure is still there. So that's the beauty of sports.
Yes, although if you go down that path, I think after 38 years, we need something else to cheer on in this team. Now, granted, the Bulls and Blackhawks, even the Cubs and White Sox have won World Series, so we've had other teams to root for. But the Bears have been the new exercise in futility for this city. I mean, it's been a long time.
I hope springs eternal. I really like the look of Caleb Williams so far, and I know it could be a really fun season, Soldier Field.
Maybe tomorrow I'll ask people to tell me what is the sports memory that hurts. I think you are smart to say that winning feels better than losing hurts, but I think a lot of us have some stories about the ground ball went through my legs, or I missed the 20-foot shot, or worse yet, the layup at the buzzer, right?
Oh, well, I have some of those stories too, but I see we're running out of time, so I don't...
We are. The Mincing Rascals post another podcast tomorrow. I'll visit with you on other topics, including the DNC, only because when we recorded last week, it was Wednesday at 2, and we still had half of Wednesday night speakers and all of Thursday to get out of Dodge. I think everybody will agree with you, though. Chicago put on a good show. That and more on the Mincing Rascals podcast with Eric Zorn and company. Eric's the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel. It's a weekly newsletter you can get for free if you email ericzorn@gmail.com. Thank you, Mr. Zorn.
Thanks, John.